I'm Neil.
I'm Louise.
And I'm Ronnie.
I'm Daisy's dad.
I'm Daisy's mum.
And I'm Daisy's grandpa.
In 2018, Daisy was diagnosed with regressive autism.
She gradually lost all of her speech and began to show typical autistic traits.
She'd spin in circles, avoid eye contact, and make loud monotone noises.
This was a huge shock, as up until this point, Daisy had been speaking in 7 or 8 word sentences.
And had memorised pretty much 20 to 30 books.
Since then, we've all been on a journey of discovery.
In this podcast, we'll talk about that journey.
And explore the impact autism has had on all of us.
The lows.
And the highs. This is the story of Daisy.
And me.
Episode 5. Why?
Welcome to the Daisy and Me podcast. It's been a while since we did this, guys. We're going to have to learn. Well, I don't have to learn because I'm a professional. but you guys, you know, getting up to speed again will be tough.
How to talk into a microphone.
Yes.
Yeah, and sound vaguely...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just about manage most days.
Yeah, okay. What's your theme today?
So today we're going to talk about the question, why? So there's all sorts of different ways you can put that in terms of our experience with Daisy as to sort of, it's the most common thing we ask ourselves is, why is she feeling like that? Why is she waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning? Why this, why that, why the other? And actually we also speak to, later on in the podcast, we speak to Professor Sir Simon Baron Cohen, who's a director of the Autism Research Centre at the University of Cambridge. And I started by asking him why autism? Why did he want to look into autism?
Yeah.
And actually he's just fascinating on various different things, but primarily just wanting to make sure that the world understands more about autism on a scientific and personal level.
Yeah. It's a fascinating interview, encouraging as well. Mm. Really quite but there's whole things about how autism's been perceived from now to like 10 years ago, and his hopes, and we'll hear about his hopes for how autism is perceived in the years to come. We've seen quite a change in Daisy, really. Let's talk a wee bit about that. There's been an improvement. Is that the right word? I don't know if that's the right word.
I guess just to sort of paint a picture speech-wise, she's still not talking, but she seems to be developing in other ways. So there's sort of, I guess, more sort of social awareness, I would say. And what I mean by that is that she's playing with us. It's not necessarily sitting and playing with toys in the way that other children do, but things like chase. She's enjoying playing chase with us, so you can run around and sort of tickle her and then you run away and she chases after you, and it's just so lovely. And she's giggling, she just giggles all the time. And that, I think, is a really, that's quite a significant development that I've seen in her in the last few weeks.
We sort of saw a bit of it at the end of the school term, didn't we, where she was sort of interacting with peers a bit more. But actually she's really, really interacting with us, and I think she's figured out that if she gives an eye contact for certain things, she might get something out of it.
There's a sort of increased cheekiness, isn't there? I think it's always been there, but there's something, again, another level of knowingness. But I think also we've been trying to expand her communication. It's something we're still working on, I think, with her book, and she's got like separate boards and things now that we're trying to infiltrate into our everyday communication. It's quite hard. It's quite hard to adjust because we're almost having to speak in a completely different language. But I hopefully it will help her. It is a worry still that she's still not talking. It's still not, I think she's going to be 6, isn't she, in September, but I don't feel quite as bleak about things.
Do you know what's weird, isn't it? It's a date that's stuck in my head ever since we talked to him, but Max in the last series, he was 6 when he started talking. But equally, you sort of can't really hang on dates.
No.
Because you don't.
What would you like?
Banana.
Raisins?
Yeah.
Orange?
No.
Strawberries?
Strawberries.
Strawberries? strawberries?
Yeah.
Raspberries? Blackberries? Yogurt?
Yogurt.
Yogurt?
Yogurt. Yes.
Yes, please?
Yeah, please.
Being a good girl.
I think the other thing as well is she might not be talking, but she's certainly communicating.
Yes. Yeah.
Better than ever. Mm. You know, we're getting a lot of that there with the eye contact, more spatial awareness as well, yeah, of you know, of things. When we took her up to the beach, we took her up to Hunstanton, and she was taking everything. She does these kind of, as I call it, windswept and romantic looks into the sea. She stands there just looking in and taking and think, we should all do a wee bit more of that.
It's a bit, you know, like the Titanic.
Yeah, she's just looking there.
Actually, I've got a picture of you behind her, like, and she's like, you know.
So she's communicating that way. I mean, the speech thing is still there, but I don't kind of fret about that too much now. I don't, because you're getting so much back. I just think about when you and I, what a day that was, when we built the trampoline together, father and son, spanners, electric drills, and not one, well, there was a couple of swear words.
Not one crossed word.
No, not, you know, no, we didn't.
We were cross at the trampoline, but not each other.
But we got it done. Then the great thing was when she came in and saw it.
Yeah.
And that's all happening now, isn't it?
She sees
things, and that's new. I want to play on that.
Yeah. And just sort of acknowledging things more. So things like aeroplanes, trains, when they're going past. Other children even. Just taking her to the park the other day with mum, and there were two young children standing outside the park, and she just walked up and she touched the little boy just on his cheek, and he sort of looked and he smiled at her and she smiled back, and then she just walked into the park. But I said to my mum, that's the way that she says hello to people, because that's the only way that she can say hello. But it's actually she's interested in interacting, and I think that's the thing that's really important,
not one to try yourself though.
No,
especially not at the moment. No. Just might get a punch on the nose. But that's the other thing, is actually, as she gets older, there's that sort of balance, isn't there? You don't want to stop her doing things like that, but actually, we are going to have to teach her at some point that it's not appropriate to just go up and touch random strangers. But
And just in terms of the sort of why thing, that's probably the biggest why, isn't it? Why can't she talk?
Yeah.
Why won't she talk?
Yeah.
I mean, some people have said to me, is it that she can't or that she won't?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know what to say, because it might be both. It might be that sometimes she can't physically get the words out, and it might be sometimes that she won't because she doesn't want to talk. Or it's
really, I think, again, it comes back to that whole, I still can't quite get my head around autism and the non-verbal and verbal. Mm-hmm. And actually speaking to different people and reading different books, there are some people that think they're talking and actually what's coming out isn't words.
Yeah.
There's a confidence issue for some. I don't suspect with Daisy it's a confidence thing. I don't, because she is
confident.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like that's it. I think it's just her voice and her speech was so articulate. When you listen to her back, it was so clear. Her pronunciation of words was so clear.
It's the hardest thing to make sense of, isn't it? The lack of communication and autism.
Yeah.
Because we know that she is really intelligent.
Yeah.
And clearly understands and clearly learns stuff.
Yeah.
You can sort of understand all the other behaviours, like the stimming, the not eye contact, because there's a sort of, there's a rational sort of thing behind that. But can't wrap my head around it.
I think the other thing as well, because Sky has been trialling out some of the kind of the tablet communication stuff as well. And you think that's really good, because she will be able to communicate more. But will that take away the sort of impulse to speak?
Yeah.
Will she go, well, I don't need to speak because you guys, I just press that and you know exactly what I'm doing.
I can remember having those conversations really early on with the speech and language therapist when she was doing the initial picture exchange. And I think we had conversations as a family to say, is this going to stop her from talking? But I can remember then reading something, and it might have been Sky or the SLT we were talking to, that actually, it's about, if, at the moment, she can't talk, so we have to enable a form of communication for her.
Yeah.
And actually, the thinking behind it is that the more that someone is wanting to communicate, the more likely they are to be able to talk. I don't know.
I just don't know. It's a weird one, isn't it? It's something, yeah, I wrestle with that. But I guess if someone had broken their leg, you wouldn't say, you're not allowed any crutches.
Yeah, yeah.
You just say, well, walk when you can. You say you got crutches for now, eventually. And it's a way of trying to get her sort of to fitness in that sense. Mm.
She's so good with her tablet and things, maybe probably too good.
Yeah.
With how she uses it and everything. She's even doing it with her toes the other day.
She's using her feet on the screen.
I've tried the hands thing. Let me just try this one.
As humans, we've sort of lost the, you know, I don't know what happened in evolution and we don't use our feet for stuff.
No. Daisy does. Daisy picks stuff up with her feet. She'll walk through the living room and there'll be something in the middle of the floor and you'll look and then she'll just have it in her toe and she's walking with it.
Save a lot of bending down.
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's efficient.
And just, by the way, just on the tablet, the sort of speech thing, we will be doing auditions for who... It's going to be Daisy's voice.
Oh, well, yes.
So,
I think... And I think it should be Scottish me.
Yeah.
I'm hungry. You're annoying me, Dad.
You just get a really aggressive voice on there.
Leave me alone.
But the other thing Simon was talking about was the way that the perceptions... of autism have changed over the years.
Yeah.
He's talking about is because obviously he's been in it for 30 years. On that sort of why aren't there sort of more services for autistic children? Why isn't there more acceptance? I don't know what you feel about the acceptance. Is it because we've been with her for longer that it doesn't register quite as much to me now?
What about her not being accepted?
Not being accepted.
I think
I used to think about it a lot more, but now maybe that's me.
I think some of it is about circumstance and what's happening in life at the time, though, isn't it? Because at the moment, we're in a good, I want to touch wood, that we've had some obviously up that's and down days. Oh, is that a wall?
Again? It was a rainy day when I came to play down by the sea. I climbed aboard a pirate ship and the captain said to me, we're going this way, that way, forwards, backwards, up and down, round and round, over the deep blue sea. Diddly dee dee dee. Again?
We've had some sort of up and down days like we do, but actually the routine has been quite set. She's been going to school, she's enjoying school, and because she's been happy, everything sort of feels quite good. But I think that probably there will be times when there's change. So for instance, when she changes school, when she becomes a teenager, there will be new experiences that she has and that we have as her parents that will mean that probably those anxieties are raised again for us. I don't know. That's just my feeling. Without
what about
being
you,
optimistic.
I don't. I'm really encouraged. Really, what's going on? I think for me, we're really lucky because he talks about empathy, we do get that. We're so lucky because, in a way, we got educated when she wasn't doing anything with us. Mm. Remember that time when she completely regressed and was taking no interest in anything whatsoever, anything. Even food wasn't a really big thing then.
Yeah.
So what we get now, the smiles, the cuddles and everything, kind of reassures me that as she presents, if you take her to a different school, I think there's people will see the potential. Yeah. I'm encouraged by that. I think, if there was other issues, then there might be, problems about, getting funding and everything. Mm. So I'm quite encouraged that there'll be something to see. And the way that she's performing with numbers and everything now, and remember we were talking as well about way back at the start, somebody says, I forget who it was, that said, find the obsession.
Yeah.
And I don't think we've found the complete, but we've got a rough idea of some of the things
she
gets obsessed with, not just food, but she likes
numbers,
alphabet, jigsaw, and placing them and trying to get them in
order. Mm. Yeah. It's sequencing, isn't it? And again, I think that's sort of something that's quite interesting when you listen to the interview. And actually, if anyone gets an opportunity to read the book, because what Simon talks about is the sort of patterns and the sort of way that the autistic brain works. And actually, you can see that very clearly with Daisy, is that she is very... she feels very comfortable with sequences.
And another word we got, because we've got one of these massive, sort of fit together alphabets. We thought it was going to be small. It's practically the size of the front room. And we got that. And so she did it and sorted it out. Then she got it, and then she put the letters in different positions. And I was trying to do my usual thing. Now, you put the L there, and she was wanting, she said, quite happy. Then we played the game of, find the A, right? And then so she was actually moving about this. So she wanted to play that rather than just put everything out in order.
Yeah.
I'll find them for you.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, yes.
There's a process.
She set herself a challenge.
Yeah.
Mm. And it was amazing to see her just doing that and actually being cheeky about it. Because you remember when she used to celebrate when she did the jigsaws before she regressed. Mm. And it was like a lap of honour every time she did it.
Yeah.
And I think that happens. I think she does do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's responding to social praise in ways that she never did as well. I think sort of since the regression, again, even things like the toilet training, because we're still in the midst of that at the moment, but actually there's significant improvement in that she's managing to get most of her needs in the toilet, isn't she? But she's...
I think that's a learning experience. As one thing we've learned with Daisy is that she'll pick the moments, really.
Yeah,
I do. How do you feel, having listened to the slightly negative aspect of that interview, and you'll hear it as well, is that it's a fight for resources.
Yeah.
Without, because we, you and I, Lou, as we've talked before, we go off way too far ahead. Is that still at the back of your mind? You're going to have to fight for everything.
It's very difficult, because actually what you see is the parents you meet at school, like you see, like there's one parent she was having a struggle getting funding for a place in a specialist autistic school. And you think, is that going to be us a couple of years down the line? We're lucky in the support structure we've got.
Yeah.
In terms of, if we can evidence it, and it will be obvious that she needs a certain kind of help.
This is the thing, though, isn't it? And actually, this is something that, again, in the interview, and we'll probably talk a bit about stuff afterwards, but actually what Simon refers to is that autism is a lifelong disability. Do you want to call it a disability? It's a lifelong condition. It's something that people have. It never goes away.
No.
And actually, I find it really frustrating that we have to continually evidence in order to get funding.
Yeah.
Daisy is autistic. She has these needs. Yes, they may change slightly over time, but those needs are always going to be there. And why do we have to keep justifying it every single time? It all comes down to money. And if they can remove funding, they will, because they don't want to be giving money, because there isn't enough money, is there? So but it's frustrating even for things like benefits. You have to redo the whole massive sort of it's like 30 pages. I can't remember. It took me about 14 hours to fill it in.
Well, Anna Kennedy talked about this, fighting every, she's quite formidable. It's a great interview. Listen back to one of those podcasts, Anna Kennedy. But the other thing as well, as we've said before, we can take these on. You've got experience. Mm. We're quite good with words and everything. I still fear for the single parent who's having to do this themselves without a massive support network and knows that they need it but can't actually get through to the right people. to get it done.
Yeah, and a lot of things, if you don't have the right people around you, mm-hmm. you just don't think of stuff.
No.
You don't think, oh, I better do that now, or
but you know,
get told to apply for things.
Well, that's the other thing I was thinking, is that it's the summer holidays, and actually, having sort of spoken to a couple of other people, their children are attending sort of summer activities that are set up or geared up for children with autism, and actually it's not easy to find that, and actually we were too late to sort anything out now for this summer. But why is that information not, why are we not being given that information? Yeah. Why do we have to go out and find that? You're constantly having to search for stuff whilst you're trying
I'd like to know if those days are oversubscribed, which case then you know then that they can't just go willy-nilly because the numbers are too much. If they're undersubscribed, then you'd have to say, right, hang on, you've set this up. Are you not telling enough people?
Yeah.
You know, your publicity needs to be better.
Yeah.
Because it can help, you know, during the summer holiday, 6 weeks. It's a long time.
And actually it is unsettling for Daisy. We know that she's been quite upset. I mean, there was a bit of upset prior to the summer holidays starting because COVID reasons, quite a number of children got sent home, didn't they? So that threw her.
Yeah.
Then she was back, then she was off again. And actually even just being off, although she's with us and it's people she knows, she has struggled with the change again. And it's a change that you wouldn't expect for her to find difficult because she's with us, but it's difficult because she's not in her usual routine.
Yeah.
So actually having structured stuff during the summer holidays would be really helpful. But I know that we're going to have to explore that before next year comes around. We're going to have to look into that and plan it because we need to find out ourselves, don't we?
But yeah, if we do too much structured stuff, you don't get as much time with that. Clearly. We've got to balance that.
Well, it's something we need to talk about in the future, negotiations. Yeah. Hey, listen, let's get to the interview.
Yeah.
So Professor Sir Simon Baron-Cohen, bit of a mouthful, but,
It's important to get it all in, though.
Important to get it all in. Director of the Autism Research Centre at the University of Cambridge. He had, just before I spoke, released a book called The Pattern Seekers, which is a fantastic book, and I'd recommend it because when you're reading about autism, you tend to read about sort of anecdotal stuff, so it would be the mum of, or the parent of, or the child. Simon's fantastic at putting the science in there and making it make sense. So I talk about us in the interview, there's a bit in his book about a child that watches a washing machine spin, and the explanation is that they like the pattern of the washing machine, they like that process, and it made sense in my head with Daisy. But it's a great book to just kind of put your head in what autism is about and what it actually means for kids like Daisy. But I spoke to him, it was a little while back now, but it's a fascinating interview.
Reading a lot about you, and obviously knowing of your work because I'm a journalist by trade and I've seen you in the news so many times talking about autism. What interested me was why autism? You're obviously a neuroscientist by background, but what made you pursue the field of autism?
Yeah. So going all the way back, because I've been in autism research for over 30 years, but when I graduated from university, I got a job as a teacher in a small unit for autistic kids. So I'd studied something called human sciences at university, which is a sort of mix of social and biological sciences. And then got this teacher in this unit where there were just six autistic kids. This is in the early 80s, where there wasn't a lot known about autism in those days. And it was a real opportunity for me to just kind of get to know six kids in a lot of detail and their families. And I just found it sort of, interesting. You know, for me, it kind of sparked a curiosity, which took me back into doing a PhD in research to try and understand it better. But the research all the way through has tried to balance what we call basic research, sort of trying to understand the causes, but also applied research, you know, what might be helpful.
What is it in that sense then that interests you about autism? Because obviously when we talk about autism, there's a lot of stigma that goes with it. And actually, in a lot of cases, you know, particularly among family members, there may be confusion that goes with it. But clearly something interests you to want to get involved with it. Is there anything in particular, or is it just the broad spectrum of it?
So, you know, what interests me has changed over the years. You know, part of it is the fact that, I don't know, different aspects of psychology within autistic people seem to not follow the typical track. So, for example, you can have somebody who's got really good intelligence, but who struggles socially. So these two aspects of the mind seem to be kind of not aligned, should we say. You know, part of what interests me also is the way that the spectrum itself is changing. You know, so back in the day when I started, we weren't really seeing as many people who have, you know, an absence of learning difficulties. Most autistic kids and adults had, you know, additional learning difficulties as well as autism, whereas now that's changed a lot. You know, so we're sort of the spectrum itself is moving and changing all the time. And that means that the needs of the individuals that we're thinking about is also changing. So there's a lot. And then I suppose the third thing that's changed over those decades is that we now have very different tools available to us for research. So 30 years ago, it would have been difficult to look at the genetics of autism. Whereas today that technology exists. You know, we see it even during the pandemic, you know, that they're sequencing the virus as it's mutating. And, you know, we can use those same tools to sequence the DNA of autistic people. So it's just, you know, so it's kind of as the world changes, autism is changing too. And we just have to keep on, you know, we have to keep up to date.
It's really interesting you say that the world of research around autism has changed so much in the last 30 years, because clearly one of the other things that has changed is the attitudes towards autism. There is a growing sort of acknowledgement of autism and you know, the fact that the spectrum is wider than we ever thought.
Yeah.
Just take us back to the 80s.
What was it
like trying to pursue a research in a field that perhaps was misunderstood?
Yeah, so I mean, when I started, people might ask me what I do, and I would say I work with autistic kids, and people wouldn't know the word, whereas today it's an everyday household word, you know, and they might even mishear it and say artistic, and I said no, autistic, you know. So it was just kind of, you know, awareness wasn't very high. I suppose the second thing is that researchers tended to assume that they were the experts, whereas today, because many autistic people are very vocal and are being self-advocates, they're reminding researchers that actually we need to consult autistic people, children and adults, about their lived experience. So, you know, so 20 or 30 years ago, it was very uncommon to design studies with the autism community. Whereas today, that's almost a given, that we should be consulting with autistic people. You say the world has changed, you know, that now there's kind of more awareness. And I think that's true. But what really frustrates me is that actually services are still appalling. So it was true back then, and I think it's still true, that there are long waiting lists to get your child assessed, or if you're an adult seeking a diagnosis, to, you know, to get seen. And even if you're lucky enough to get a diagnosis, often there are very few services that follow up, because we know autism isn't something that just goes away. It's part of who you are. So it's a lifelong condition, which means there really needs to be a sort of, you know, a pathway of support right across the individual's life for when they need it. And they should be able to dip in and out as they need it.
And that, you know, personally speaking, that's something that we've seen particularly even more so during the pandemic. you know, the removal of things like speech and language therapy, you know, the removal of one-to-one occupational therapy, that kind of thing. And it is, you're right, it is frustrating because, you know, on some level you try and sort of be deferential and say, well, no, we're in a bigger thing, this is a pandemic. But we're looking at our daughter, who's nonverbal, and thinking, we've got a ticking clock here. You know, we've only got a certain amount of time to really, really focus on this. And it's, yeah. You're right, it's so frustrating.
Yeah. And although at one level you're right that the pandemic has to take priority, you know, it's a global issue, you know, people are dying. You know, autism is not less important, you know. So, for example, mental health, you know, poor mental health rates are really high in autism. Suicidality amongst autistic adults is really high. You know, so in the same way that that COVID can be fatal, you know, currently the lack of support for autistic people can also be fatal. I don't think we should kind of minimize the importance of autism. The last thing I'd say is that although things are improving, and I really welcome all the changes towards inclusion and so-called neurodiversity, kind of just acknowledging that we all have different types of brains. Nevertheless, there is still stigma, and I think we've still got quite a battle to totally remove stigma, because stigma shouldn't really exist at all. I mean, it's like any form of discrimination. You know, we wouldn't tolerate racism in small amounts. We just say zero tolerance. And the same should apply to stigma towards people with, you know, developmental disabilities, including autism.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I want to talk about your new book, The Pattern Seekers, which I've been reading. And what strikes me is every comparison you make with, you know, perhaps an inventor of, you know, from history, there's so much in terms of the way they focus on patterns that reminds me of Daisy. And actually what I got when I was reading it was I sort of got those light bulb moments where I went, oh, that's why she stares at the washing machine when it's on, you know, that sort of thing. But one of the things I was really quite interested in, because obviously you talk about the extreme male brain, and that being sort of loosely sort of linked to the kind of brain you get in autistic people. Daisy's obviously a girl, and what is weird about her presentation is that she's obviously very autistic. She's got all the typical behaviors, she's nonverbal, but she's in a minority in so much that she is a girl. And I wondered whether that extreme male brain applies to females regardless of their gender. Do you know, is an extreme male brain applicable in a girl?
Yeah. So where to start? I mean, I suppose the term extreme male brain can be a bit misleading, because some people think, oh, it can't possibly apply to me because I'm female, or it can't apply to my daughter because she's female. And when you look more closely at the theory about the extreme male brain, actually it's about these two different aspects of the mind, systemizing, which is the ability to sort of see patterns in the world, particularly causal patterns, you know, what is causing what, and then empathy, which is a very different sort of process, you know, the ability to put yourself into someone else's shoes, to imagine their thoughts and feelings. And these psychological processes seem to be linked to gender in the general population. So on average, males seem to have a much stronger interest in systems or patterns. And on average, females seem to develop empathy faster, you know, than boys. And so when you look at the typical gender differences in empathy and systemizing, and then you look at people with autism, you know, regardless of their gender, what you tend to see is this profile. We call it an extreme of the typical male profile, but it's basically where empathy may be below average, but systemizing may be not just intact, sometimes superior. You know, that's where you see the strengths and the talents. And then back to my book, this new book called The Pattern Seekers. It really explores the positive sides of autism. You know, this side of autism that's been neglected, I think. You know, we know that they have social difficulties and communication difficulties. That's part of the diagnosis. But this other side, you know, the strong interest in patterns, which sometimes translates into talent. You know, that's where the book focuses. And in the book, I make the link that, as you were saying earlier, right across human history, people who invent, people who come up with new ways of doing things to understand a system better, have been people who are strongly focused on patterns, particular kinds of patterns, you know, like how systems work. And so we can see autism as having played a key role in human progress, you know, across the evolution of Homo sapiens. That's what the book's about.
And I mean, you know, you cite examples like Thomas Edison, you know, being showing autistic characteristics. I wonder then, going back to what you were saying about stigma, given your book highlights such a positive impact on the world with regards to people who might have been autistic and you know, have contributed to the way we live. Is there any... There's an argument that actually what we're underrepresented in the workplace with autistic people.
Yeah.
And actually your book is one of the few at the moment that highlights the talents of autistic people. How do you think we get more autistic people back into work and making sure that we are harnessing the power of their mind?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book, it's part of a genre called popular science. It's making sure that the research isn't just staying inside universities, but it's going out into society, including employers, but also many other sectors in society. So education, social services, medicine. You know, we need to get the message out that autistic people do have contributions they can make, and that currently they are being excluded from society. Unemployment is just one example of exclusion. But a lot of kids get excluded from school, autistic kids, or they just feel excluded from even leisure, you know, being able to participate and have fun, to have good quality of life. And the stigma thing, we have to keep coming back to it, is that in our research, we've found a lot of autistic people have been bullied, have been the victim of violence, have experienced poverty, exploitation, lots of negative things. You know, so the book is really saying, on the one hand, look at the remarkable things that autistic people have done across the millennia. You know, human civilization wouldn't be where it is today, in all likelihood, without autistic people. And yet, on the other hand, look at how we're treating them. It's almost that juxtaposition. You know, we owe them a huge debt so that we can use technology, we can use complex tools, all the way back 70,000 years ago to the bow and arrow, through to, you know, using Zoom today. You know, all of our inventions were likely produced by people who had a lot of autistic traits, because when we do the research, we see these two things go hand in hand, that the people who are good at technology tend to also have elevated numbers of autistic traits, higher levels of autistic traits. So on the one hand, you know, we owe civilization where we are today to autistic people. And on the other hand, we're treating them as if they don't matter, as if they're, you know, less important than the rest of us. And it's time for a change, really.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, you just hope that we are at that sort of zenith where things are going to change, you know, but clearly more work needs to be done. Do you think, you know, there are so many negatives that have come out of the pandemic, notwithstanding the loss of life and everything, but also the lack of support. Do you think the renewed focus on science and research might have a good effect on the drive for policy? Because clearly we've seen that we can make policy based on science during this pandemic.
Yeah.
Do you think it will have a good effect going forward on things like autism?
I hope so. I mean, I think you're right that I think the UK were a bit slow to follow the science, which is now the phrase that they use. And that was also true in other countries, including the US. You know, they were slow to lock down, slow to put in restrictions, even though the scientists were recommending it. Whereas now I think it's almost a given that politicians aren't the experts in this. You know, politicians have to decide on spending priorities, you know, ultimately, but they do need the advice of scientists when it comes to public health. And I think that should be true of autism just as much as COVID, sure.
Just finally, Simon, I wondered where you see the country on an imagined arc of autism. So if we think of autism as a sort of story arc through the ages,
yeah,
where do you think we are, and is it a positive place or a negative place?
Oh no, I think, you know, even across my own career, which as I said is 30 years, I can see lots of positives, and if I sort of try and crystal ball gaze, you know, where are we going to be in 10 years time, I would hope that autism will be at the place that dyslexia is at. So dyslexia, if you go back, you know, to past decades, you know, those were the kids who weren't reading, but they were thought to be lazy or naughty or disruptive. People didn't really realize that they had, you know, a disability when it comes to reading. Then there was the recognition that dyslexia is a disability. And nowadays there's a whole wealth of teaching methods, teaching materials, teaching tools. And the term dyslexia doesn't carry any stigma. You know, if you say I'm dyslexic, people say, so what, right? And what I'm hoping is that autism will get to that place, that within 10 years, there'll be a whole wealth of services out there for autistic people. And that when someone says I'm autistic, their employer, their education setting, wherever they are, you know, their local social group, whatever it is, will just say, no big deal. You know, you're welcome. And, you know, let us know what we can do to make life more comfortable. So it should just become more ordinary. And that's what I'm hoping. But I think if you look at the arc, as you said, I think it's all traveling in the right direction.
So, I mean, what an interesting man. It's just really, really fascinating.
One thing we've learned in this podcast is there's a lot of interesting people there, you know, and the knowledge is just amazing.
And just how privileged are we to be having the experience of interviewing these people?
Yeah.
And I mean, this would never happen if it wasn't for Daisy having autism. So I actually feel quite humbled listening to people like him, because to dedicate your whole career to autism, which is what he's done, I mean, for us, it's just incredible to know that there are people who want to find out more about autism, but also that want to share their information, and their goal is to really enable everyone to understand autism and to accept it. I think that's just...
It makes you feel better about the future, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because you know that when we're talking about science... You know, there's the big sort of, you know, the cancer, the sort of, you know, all the dementia stuff.
And yeah.
There's the sort of big charity names. But it's nice to know that someone is specifically looking at how to, you know, analyse autism.
I think the big one for me that really wagged my tail was, the you know, saying, listen, if you don't have an autistic person in your workforce... You're missing out.
Yeah.
Because they are brilliant.
Yeah.
You should, if you don't, well, because you're missing, because, and that whole history side of things of, you know, the people who would have presented as autistic that have made a major sort of impact in society and science was so, you know, it was like the superpower thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which I thought, well, this is the way we should be looking at it.
Yeah,
it's really interesting as well, isn't it? I remember when I first started reading more about autism because of Daisy, and I can remember this whole thing. You read stuff and people say, oh, well, people talk to you about Rain Man, and they just assume that because you've got an autism, you're going to be a really intelligent person. And actually, I was sort of, I was thinking to myself, okay, so there are going to be some people with autism who do have high intelligence, and then there are perhaps some people with autism who maybe don't have high intelligence, but because there are also children or people that have learning disabilities alongside. And he was saying that actually what they're seeing now, I think from sort of remember what you talked about, was that there seems to be an increase in autism in children, but also the ability to learn, so not those learning difficulties alongside it. And I started to wonder if actually perhaps most autistic people do have that high intelligence, it's just that they're not enabled to reach that potential, that's the bit that's missing.
I think that his sort of looking ahead, the fact that, you know, it's going to be viewed in a different way, hopefully. But the tools that are available, we talked about the tools that are available now for parents and teachers. Mm. It's much more, than it was. But it's getting to it. He said something there that he said the kind of support is quite terrible.
Yeah,
he said it must be frustrating for somebody like him.
Yeah,
but, you know, we could do so much here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that his interview, albeit there's been a big gap in the podcast, but the last person we spoke to was Dame Stephanie.
Yeah.
And her experience with Giles was so much different to what we are, where we are now. But even Simon's saying there's still room for improvement.
Yeah.
There's still a way to go until, like you said, we've got people in the workforce who are autistic and can offer a different perspective.
Massive
and
amounts to
it's interesting. For work, I was we have a diversity panel who people from different backgrounds who come and watch the program and sort of offer us feedback on. And my boss said, would you mind coming to this and just talking a bit about Daisy and a bit about the podcast? And I didn't realize it until I'd said it, but I didn't realise quite how much Daisy's given me in terms of my perspective on the world.
Yeah.
Because I think about the lack of diversity in my life before Daisy.
Yeah.
I had no clue.
Absolutely.
About anything.
Yeah.
And now, knowing her, the thought that there's a place in the world for her to get a job and to live, that it would be alien not to think that. Like, why wouldn't she?
Yeah.
But it's just, again, because of how things are and because there is a lack of inclusion, there's the worry, isn't there? Because we want to ensure she gets there and it's still not as it should be. I wanted to ask you both, it was just something that struck me in the interview as well that I sort of came away feeling quite anxious about, and I've been thinking a lot about over the last few days, but what did you sort of feel about the sort of talking about the brain, the male brain, and the sort of traits of empathy, and perhaps in autism, maybe not having quite that same level of empathy.
Well, it's interesting because when I read the book, he puts it so brilliantly in that generally speaking, people who have autism will present with what is called an extreme male brain. which signifies a lack of empathy, but heightened intelligence, more analysis.
Yeah.
I don't think Daisy fits that. I don't know what it is about that, but I sort of think she, we've talked about it, I think she does have some empathy. You worried more about the future?
I think so. And again, this just comes down to what my expectations of how things should be are. And that's where I'm wrong and I need to step back. I think because of how I am as a person, I'm probably the other extreme of that. I think I'm probably sometimes so empathetic that it's to my own detriment, if that makes sense. Does that sound?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, sometimes it's quite painful when you have that much empathy. It can be quite. It's probably why I became a nurse. I don't know. But I think you often want your children to inherit some of the traits that you see as positive traits. So the prospect of Daisy not having empathy to me feels quite strange. However, I think if you were to speak to a lot of autistic people, they maybe wouldn't necessarily agree that they don't have empathy. I don't know whether it's a very tricky one.
And I think you're right, because we can when we talk about we're good time, we're good moments with Daisy later. I think our perception of what is empathy,
yeah,
right,
is maybe different.
Is maybe different for anybody. You might think you're being, I don't think you've got much empathy for me.
Yeah, well, that's just that a would, different yeah, matter.
That would be too hard work.
Yeah, now we get it.
I know
what empathy I need, but do I get it? No.
You're just pathetic.
Yeah, I'm just pathetic. But I think, but it is that of an especially with an autistic child, and it's identifying it and saying that is empathy.
Yeah,
that is
I think little things like you were talking about earlier, the hello, which just that's empathy to me.
Well, it's not communication. It's not empathy. Is putting yourself. I mean, you wouldn't expect necessarily a small child to fully understand the concept of empathy anyway. But it's things like I'm just trying to think of a. I don't know. I think it's about removing our expectations of what she should be as well, because I think you can teach people morals and values and maybe how they should treat other people. Mm. Doesn't necessarily mean it's an intrinsic process that will happen, but as long as we teach her certain ways, if that makes sense. But I think it's down to think that one of the things that really strikes me with Daisy, I remember, I don't think we've talked about it in the podcast, but there was an occasion where I was at home on my own with her. She was sat at the table eating lunch and I was trying to make her laugh by doing a silly dance, and I slipped on her communication book and I went smack forwards onto the kitchen floor, smacked my nose. I thought I'd broken it and there was quite a lot of blood everywhere. And she just looked and carried on eating, which in some ways was brilliant. I wouldn't have wanted for her to be upset, but any other child whose mum had fallen over and injured themselves, and it sounds like a really strange thing to talk about, but it just really hit me that it didn't mean anything. It didn't mean anything.
I wonder what reaction you'd get now.
I don't think it would be any different. I think
she might laugh.
She'd probably laugh, but it's not. I didn't want her to be upset, but it just dawned on me that if ever anything serious happened to one of us with her, do you know what I mean? As she gets older, but also when you yawn, Daisy doesn't yawn. You know how most people yawn. There's something I've noticed. It's a sort of intrinsic. She doesn't yawn in response in the same way that most. It sounds negative. It's not that I'm being negative, but it was really thought provoking when I started to think about empathy, and it made me think back to those occasions.
There's things like that, and I'm just looking at some of my notes here. Just to go back over the fact that, we go back to this, a lifelong condition.
Mm.
And he was, the professor was bothered about the no follow-up thing aspect to it as well.
Yeah.
And he said that autism is no less important than mental health issues.
Yes.
Which I thought was, that I've never heard anybody
and
say.
And very difficult to separate.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing as well, isn't it? Is that we know that the rate of mental health illness issues in people with autism is high.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, that when, like, we talk about COVID and services not running, it's so short-sighted, because ultimately down the line, lack of support now means increased mental health issues. So it's going to cost the government.
Just one last thing from it, because listeners, if you want to get in touch with us about this, we'd love to hear from you what you take away from it. He says at the end, he hopes that the day will come with the advance that dyslexia has lost its stigma.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. He hopes that autism becomes that thing as well.
Yeah.
The people just say, oh, yeah, you're autistic. Yeah, fair enough. And there's not that kind of thing, because we hear somebody dyslexic, now we don't bother.
Mm.
Where it was a big stigma, it was associated with supposed lack of intelligence, and it was the opposite as well. So I think for me, that's the podcast is really important, and the more people we get to talk about, and the more people we get to be open about the autism and other issues as well, it's going to be good for raised awareness, so that maybe one day, Lou, that we don't have to go up and say, by the way, she's autistic.
And I think as well, it's really good to think about some of the stuff that was talked about, because although it can be, you can sort of worry about it, I just sort of come back to that empathy. Actually, I don't, although I think about these things, it's actually helping me to process stuff. So it's not that I'm seeing things in a negative way. It's just thought provoking.
No, it's good.
And actually, I think you're right. There's a lot with Daisy. I think there's a lot of affection. And I think maybe there is more going on empathy wise than we realize. Yeah. I don't know.
Let's just end up with we're good. We've had a long time to think. I've got one I want to talk about. And this is just our moments when Daisy just opens up her life a bit more. We were up at Sunny Honey for fish and chips. We had a great day, didn't we?
Yeah.
It was brilliant. We went out there. And we sat in the green. We had fish and chips. And Dad's been Dad said, say thank you to Grandpa for fish and chips. And she did. She did do that. But eventually she came round the back of me and just, and we're sitting in the grass. And she just cuddled me from behind. I says, oh, this is lovely. And he says, that's her thanking you.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, wow, of course it is. But I hadn't identified. I just thought I was going to cuddle and I had absolutely no problem with that. Aww. But she was actually coming round and just going, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is great. And
that's lovely.
And it is. And we're very lucky with that. These are the golden moments. What about you, Neil?
mine's going to sound vulgar, but it's quite a big moment, actually. Daisy has been passing wind a lot.
I wonder where she gets that from.
Well,
yeah,
yeah, it's not me. But just in the past few weeks, she started laughing at them.
Oh, right.
She's never noticing them.
Yeah,
and she's holding her breath before, which means she's pushing. So she's sat there a couple of nights where we've just been downstairs pottering, and she'll just go, smile on her face, hold a breath, and then just go, and then laugh.
And then laugh.
It's hilarious. We shouldn't encourage it, but funny.
It's funny, and it's lovely because she's never really paid any attention to them before, which again, it's funny because we laugh, don't we, when she does it, and she's just oblivious, but it's the recognition that
I've played that video. I've put the audio of that video in the podcast before where she's reading The Highway Rat.
Oh, yeah.
And she trumps halfway through and then just carries on as if nothing's happened.
Punctuation.
Yeah. But now she laughs at it. It's great.
And what about you, Lou?
I think for me, we went to Centre Parks, didn't we, last week?
Yeah.
So it's a holiday that had been delayed about four times because of COVID. So to actually get there was amazing. But for me, it was seeing her there's like a water area. And she hasn't sort of done anything like that before, has she, with the proper flumes? They're children's ones.
Yeah.
But she just loved it. And she was round, down, just constant. And just this constant smile on her face. And under the water, head getting completely soaked. And obviously holding her breath under the water, which is something I've always been a bit worried about with her. But just to see the sheer joy in her face. She's a proper water baby, isn't
she?
She's
taken to pointing at pictures of swimming pools now.
Yeah.
She really does like the water.
That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time listening to us again. There is a whole back catalogue of shows you can get on our podcast stream. If you want to get in touch with us,
DaisyandMePodcast@gmail.com and Twitter @DaisyandMePod.
We'd love to hear your views about what we're doing, and also your stories about some of the things that for you, what about empathy for you, and what about, I'm really interested in this as well, is about the help and support that's available locally where you are. I know it's we've heard it is a bit of postcode lottery with that kind of cliche, but I'd love to hear from you how little or how great the support is.
Yeah, and we're also taking auditions for Daisy's voice.
No, there's no audition.
The Daisy factor.
No. Okay, send them to me. Yeah, send them. But she's going to be speaking like me. I might even get a Lorraine Kelly.
Just imagine the greeting.
Lorraine, oh, hello. Or Billy Connolly. Hello. Where's my dinner? We will see you next time. Take care and keep safe.